A new investigation by ProPublica has found that at a handful of institutions, including Harvard University, hold thousands of remains of Native American ancestors. At Harvard alone, there are more than 1,000 individual remains. So joining us on the line is one of the reporters that worked on the project, ProPublica's Mary Huditz. She's also a past president of the Native American Journalists Association. Mary, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
One of the most striking things about this story, and I was captivated by it, is that right at the top, you talk about the fact that in 1990, Congress already passed a law, the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, and that was more than 30 years ago, but tribes still have a really difficult time reclaiming those ancestral remains.
Yes, that was, I feel like, the sort of guiding question for a lot of our investigation is why, after 30 years, when Congress issued a call for institutions to review what they had and begin to return it to tribes, that so many institutions still have so much. In fact, looking at all of the more than 600 institutions that have to comply with the law, fewer than half of the human remains they had held or ancestral remains of Native Americans have been returned.
And so just correct me if I'm wrong, but only 10 institutions, including Harvard, they hold about half of the remains that have not been returned to tribes.
That is correct.
So let's talk about some of those obstacles facing a tribe attempting to reclaim ancestral remains. Like, what are they? What happens?
We hear a range of things that or arguments that tribes have encountered. One is that repatriation is complicated or expensive. It's expensive certainly for tribes who have to travel to an institution that might be fought, like, across the country from where they are. But institutions, even those with large budgets, will say that it's very expensive and takes a lot of time and resources. Beyond that, we start to see tribes will say that they are challenged on their actual claims to their ancestors. They may have stories of, you know, that have been passed down through generations or traditions, or even items that they use that are very similar to those that the institution holds. And an institution will say that maybe they, despite the evidence the tribe is presenting, they just don't have enough to show that their ancestors are who they say they are. So that can be where a lot of the anguish of this issue starts to come in, because it goes to identity and understanding of where your people are from.
So to build on that, one thing you had in your article that was really interesting is this idea of culturally identifiable, which is something that a lot of institutions use as kind of a defense to not return those remains, because they call them culturally culturally unidentifiable. What is that, and has that worked?
Yeah, culturally unidentifiable is something many museums cast their whole collections virtually as culturally unidentifiable, despite knowing where the excavation happened and then knowing that tribes had a claim to that region, either in the present day or historically. Culturally identifiable has actually sort of started to be seen as so problematic that in new regulations that the Interior Department is proposing, they are basically proposing to do away with the term in the regulations and the law altogether. A lot of tribes find it offensive because they feel that they know who they are and they know where they come from. And to say that an ancestor is unidentifiable, I think, sort of takes away...
It kind of feels like a brazen denial of history, of your own history.
Many people feel that way, yeah.
Mm. And I should note that we did reach out to Harvard for response. We did not get one. But I'd like to bring in another voice here. That's Jean-Luc Pierrit, and he is the president of the North American Indian Center of Boston. Jean-Luc, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So I'd love to hear reactions to what you've heard so far.
Yes. So these stories actually mean a great deal to me because I'm a member of the Tunica-Biloxi tribe of Louisiana. And just as some of the background to the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, some of the legislative history and background to that actual law, some of the foundations of that is kind of the story of the repatriation of what was called the largest cache of Indian trade goods back to my own tribe, which was called the Tunica Treasure, which was leased to the Harvard Peabody Museum. But our story is not necessarily special or unique beyond sort of that history. What this is kind of a similar situation for many tribes in which either battlefields were plundered or ancestral villages were excavated to sort of like the ambitions of fortunes of grave robbers, because there's actually a market for sacred objects and human remains. So there's issues beyond the institutions actually having these within collections. And there's also a couple of gaps. Even within the ProPublica data, we still have lots of qualifications because this is institutions that are self-reporting. These are institutions that receive federal funds, and so there are still many unknown institutions which have not reported or have not receive federal funds yet are publicly funded, and may also have a remain. So while it is an immense problem to think over 100,000 remains are within institutions, it's my sense that this is only the tip of the iceberg.
And although this might sound like an obvious question, but I want to make sure we recognize the weight of what we're talking about. What does it mean to a tribe when remains are successfully reclaimed?
My grandfather and his generation that actually fought for state recognition and federal recognition, this is the proof that we are who we say we are. And there are so many tribes that are affected that are not recognized or state recognized. They're still trying to assert themselves as the living descendants. And so this is all of who we are. And just to kind of like build off the idea of what is culturally identifiable or non-culturally identifiable, even if you say, for instance, that remains are from Choctaw peoples, well, it doesn't necessarily say, what is the specific band or what is the specific tribal government that institutions should be working with for repatriation. So it really is impacting the ability of tribes for self-governance and sovereignty. So, these are some of the things that we're really dealing with.
And take us behind the scenes a little bit, because I am curious what happens once remains are returned. And I mean, are there so many tribes and so much diversity among them? And I'm wondering if they're in agreement more or less about what happens when remains are returned.
Yes, and I mean, in a general sense, there could be situations in which, let's say, for instance, because we're talking about human remains and funerary objects, in the case of human remains, tribes do need that opportunity to actually have ceremony and bury ancestors within homelands. But there are also times in which funerary objects have been out of the tribe's possession or out of the earth for so long that they have kind of lost their spirit. And so there are even times when tribes will kind of say, thank you, but this is something that is kind of lost its connection. So there are some really sensitive timing issues when it comes to human remains and funerary objects. But it absolutely takes years for these items and remains to go from institutions back into the tribes of origin.
So, as we mentioned, WBUR and ProPublica, we had a hard time getting a hold of Harvard to get the response on this, but I'm curious if you happen to have conversations with the university about this.
We have not had conversations with the actual university. However, we do have students that are community members of North American Indian Center of Boston. We have had stories related to, for instance, the hair samples that were announced at the end of last year. Originally, the Harvard Peabody Museum actually listed the names of those of the children that the hair samples were taken from these U.S.-based Indian boarding schools, and it was from that instance in which a student was actually able to alert their own tribal government, their tribal historic preservation officer, that there is a need to do repatriation. Since then, Harvard has kind of obfuscated some of the data, saying, you know, this is, you know, these are sort of like the cultures, not necessarily the tribal governments, in which the remains that need to go back to. So there's still, you know, even within sort of like this awareness that we're doing, that we're receiving from such sources as the ProPublica data, and then even announcements by the institutions themselves, there's still some reading between the lines that need to happen. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's informing tribal citizens to go back to their governments and making sure that repatriation does happen.
And I do want to say the Peabody Museum, that's Harvard affiliated, did has published a 2021 letter of apology. But Mary, I want to bring you back in this conversation. So reactions to anything you heard from John Luke?
Yeah, he brings up many excellent points. One of them is the reminder that tribes will have different preferences of how the process should go. And so that's a really good note. I think if I recall, you asked a question about maybe different claims to the same ancestors among tribes. And I feel that that is something that happens maybe less than institutions suggest it does. We have started to see, because institutions felt like, oh, well, maybe many tribes have claims to one specific geographic point where remains had been excavated from. And a lot of times now what we see is that tribes have band together and created like common committees representing, say, a dozen tribes, so that they can start to get their ancestors home that way and not feel that institutions are dividing them.
Mm. And Mary, I couldn't help but wonder, could this lead to other types of reclamation efforts down the road, beyond remains, to maybe include belongings that were initially stolen, maybe even like nationally, internationally? This could kind of follow a pattern of people, groups of people, tribes reclaiming their stuff.
Yeah, NAGPRA is often described by people who are very much for repatriation as really the floor. And not the limit to where repatriation can go, and those discussions can be. So, and ancestral remains are really what is the law sort of is able to provide data for in a little bit more of a cemented way. But yes, there's a lot of international discussion right now about reclaiming ancestors and items, and Congress even just passed a law now that I think offers tribes a little more protection sacred objects are taken to another country. So there's a lot happening in this space.
That's Mary Huditz, ProPublica reporter and a past president of the Native American Journalists Association. Thank you so much, Mary. And also John Luke Pierrit. He's the president of the North American Indian Center of Boston. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. We're going to talk about housing. I'm Yasmeen Ammer, and this is Radio Boston.